Blog Talk Radio.
March. 3 months already down, and how many go? I don't know. 646-652-4479. It's been a busy day for all of us, I'm sure, but I'm glad for all who are able to take the time to tune in tonight. We have a special show. Before I get started, of course, want to intro the reason of IMTM Worldwide Radio. It's an opportunity for all different people of the spectrums of the industries to be able to voice who they are, what they do, why they do it, and to give an audience a reason to want to participate in what they're doing, whether it be buying a product or watching something, whether it be a film or television show, all kind of different things in regards to just people in general. So I'm glad to be able to keep that going. Of course, the number, if you wish to call in tonight, 646-652-4479. And the Instagram page, you can follow the radio show, IMTM Worldwide Radio, on Instagram. Of course, you can put yourself on there for free to follow the show, blogtalkradio.com/IMTM. And, of course, the chat room is open, and I have a little note in there for all the shy people who don't want to call in. So get ready to go. Now, one thing I also do want to mention before I get started, I've never done this before. I left out a word in the title of my show, and the word is can. It's kind of important to put that word back in the title because the title says, author William Turner proves you can make the past relevant to the present. So how does that fit? Tonight, we are pleased to have another author joining our show. William Turner hails from the New England area, and he's currently in the state of California where he now lives. And we're going to discuss his life before writing, what was the motivation for him to become an author, his writing style, and much more. The historical mystery, A Murder in Our Midst, is a 1950s-era novel by Mr. Turner that blends period flavor with the race-related themes of Walter Mosley, as well as the classic twists and turns of an Agatha Christie novel. If you're a fan of Agatha Christie, this is definitely a book you should want to pick up. So get ready for an evening of mystery, y'all. Call in, tune in, listen in. This is definitely a show for all that love reading. Tell others about the show. So let's go ahead and bring our guest into the show tonight. Hello, William. Are you there?
Yes, I am, Chris. How are you doing?
Doing quite well, doing quite well. And my audience agrees with me. All right, we're good now. All right, so first and foremost, I want to thank you seriously. And again, for me personally, your genre is one I always have had a deep interest in. When I was younger, I had a lot more time than I do now, and I used to read a lot, books upon books upon books, and most of them were either science fiction or mystery related. Had a little action, a little suspense, a little plot twist here and there. So definitely all in the audience who appreciate that, I think will appreciate you speaking about your book and plans for the future as we move on, okay? But first of all, let's get to know you a little bit. William, tell us where you are from originally.
I was born in Birmingham, Alabama, and my family moved to New England. That is where I grew up. That is where I attended school. And from there, I went to Detroit, Michigan, where I worked on the mayor's staff in Detroit. From there, I came to California, worked briefly for the district attorney's office in L.A., got a job with the Department of Public Social Services, and retired as a supervisor from State Compensation Insurance Fund. So I have an eclectic background.
You surely do. Wow, that's all across the board there. So let me ask you this. As you were growing up, of course, you grew up in a time much different than it – well, much different than it is now is what I was about to say. But it was different. So what was it like growing up, and how do you feel it affected who you are today? Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, I can. I can give my impression and my experiences. When we were residing in, when my family was residing in Birmingham, Alabama, my aunt and my mother were both maids. And we were privy to economic opportunities. But my aunt worked for the vice president of the bank, as well as for the secretary to the president. As a child, I would go over and cut the grass, help clean up, or do whatever was necessary. And these were done in a predominantly white neighborhood. And I ran into no problems whatsoever. And when I got to Boston, it was not that much different. The intolerance wasn't shown as much because I went to parochial schools. The nuns were white. The students were a mix of black, Caucasian, and I think they, if memory serves, Italians. And we all went to the same school, the same church. We would go to each other's homes and all of this. And it was racially tolerant. It's not to say we didn't have schoolyard fights and all of this, but those were quickly remedied by the nuns. And we weren't exposed, per se, to the racism, the intolerance that existed outside of our closed environment.
I understand. And so what would you say?
It helped us to acknowledge racial differences. It inculcated respect for people of different backgrounds. And it was quite beneficial being in a parochial environment.
And what I was going to mention or ask you actually was then, with that being said, as far as you had some structure there, and you, even though you were able to see some things, you were not so much sheltered, but you touched it a little bit. Was there a memorable moment that you experienced that you could say that, you know, there's, whether or not you want to say it was a turning point or just something to where, you know, you're going to keep this one in your back pocket. Was there such a moment?
Well, a seminal moment was when we were in high school and we were preparing to take the PSAT test, the Scholastic Achievement Test, and everyone was apprehensive, wondering where we were going to apply based on the test results. And that was the turning point. Everybody was focused. And when the results were submitted to the school, the nuns would call out, say, for instance, one scored 2,500, one scored 1,500, and I'll never forget, one said, well, now look, we have Billy Turner. Who would have suspected? And it was like I had flown beneath the radar, just doing enough to get by. But I had demonstrated what I had absorbed on the test. And the nun stated, from your test results, it is evident that you're going to pursue something in English. I shall never forget. I was lacking in English and English grammar specifically. And in high school, it was Sister Agnes Bernard, who devoted a lot of energy and time, effort, to assist me. Because there was a time I wanted to be a mathematician, but because I was so deficient in English, it was like the knowledge I had in math just flipped positions with English, and there was no balance. It became lopsided. And it was evident when I took the SAT, and that is exactly what I pursued.
And of course, well, go ahead, I'm sorry.
It was the suturing that I received in, because the nuns were very demanding, and it paid off when I was accepted and when I pursued English as a degree.
That's an amazing story. And what I was going to say is, and you kind of alluded to it in regards to demanding, in regards to nuns and their teaching and habits and things of that nature, is that the proof is in the pudding. If you do it, they can't help but, you know, they see it, they have to react off of that. There is no alternative facts to, you know, kind of mess that up at that point. So I definitely appreciate that. And actually, that brings me to my next question. Let's see here. And okay, here we go. So what made you begin to write? So that's it. So with the nuns basically saying, okay, we can see that it's evident that you're going to pursue something in English. When it comes to writing, was it something that came naturally, or was it something that you were pushed into it? Because, of course, pursuing English, but then pursuing writing, you know, that's going into the you know, what's the word I'm looking for, the secular part of it to an extent. So what was it? Was it something that you, you know, just decided to go ahead and do, or did someone push you into it per se?
You know what, I love that question, because it brings back a vivid memory. It was in my freshman year in college when the professor wrote across the top of the paper, "It's amazing at the high rate of illiteracy here in the United States." When I saw it, I was absolutely shocked. I went to Brother Newman and Brother Ward with the paper in hand, and I asked, what in God's name is he talking about? They looked at the paper. They said, well, what he's telling you is that the paper is technically correct, but you don't have style. I'm baffled now. Then I asked, I said, well, how do I get style? How do I acquire it? And they thought for a moment, and then collectively they suggested, why don't you go to the library and read murder mysteries? They are very descriptive, different sentence structures the entire shot. Well, I spent the entire weekend at Boston's library going through murder mysteries, looking at the style, the sentence structures, the entire shot. When I went back to school that Monday, I was prepared, and that was the turning point. And Little did I realize at the time that I had been influenced by Agatha Christie, because it was her books that I had focused. And years later, it manifested itself. I had read an article in Times where the embryos of thoroughbreds were being smuggled into the United States in the stomach of rabbits. And that gave me an idea. I said, well, I'm going to create this murder mystery. And this father absolutely disapproved of his daughter marrying a sable hand. And I implanted the snakes inside of a bag and put them in the horse. And I got in touch with a vet. And he was astounded. I'll never forget what he said. I'm going to try to relate the gist of it. What in the hell did an animal do to you for you to do anything like this? And he got my name. And he told me, he said, it's absolutely not feasible, because the acid alone in the horse's stomach will kill the snakes. But I persisted. I said, could they live briefly? He said, hell no. That was the beginning of it. And I abandoned the idea, but came up with more sensible and plausible plots.
That's an amazing story right there, and just how, wow, I can't even, that's crazy. And you actually answered one of the questions I was going to ask in regards to influences, Agatha Christie, and how you actually even got to that point. And it, actually, I'm going to mention this. That's one of those deals where when you are making that decision to pursue something in particular, studying and research is kind of important. Everybody who's listening, 646-652-4479, and it takes a little bit of diligence. You know, William just took a whole weekend to make some decisions about what he might do, and he wanted to do it, you know. And a lot of people say that they, you know, want to do things, but they don't need to do it. So I just want to throw that out there just a little bit. Let me ask you this question, William. What is it about writing that you appreciate the most?
The creation of characters, which can be quite taxing. Believable plots. When people read it, they can identify with what has been suggested.
Mm-hmm.
And for the writer, is to be the killer, and balancing that is being the homicide detective to capture you, arrest you, and all of this. So it's balancing. You are definitive as being the murderer, and you are just as diligent as the detective trying to capture you. And it makes you think in different areas. And I think that is what I like most. And the input from my readers is that, does it make sense? Can I identify with that? Because once your material is published, and you've done the very best that you can possibly do, the readers are the ultimate judge, and that's reflected in the reviews that you receive. To that end,
yes,
you cannot be thin-skinned, because if they were to tell you, it doesn't make sense, you don't take umbrage. You ask yourself, why doesn't it make sense? I was on the MetroLink commuting to work when one of my when one of the passengers stated, I've read your book, but I couldn't identify with it. I said, well, first of all, I'm appreciative that you did buy the book, but I didn't know you when I was writing it, because in it, I had focused on this particular character, who's a mother, who would go to any extent and all and embrace everything to protect the child. And I thought that this covered the range of all mothers, most all of them. And I could not see why she didn't identify with it. And I asked others for their input, and I was told, well, we can't speak for what she had said, but we found absolutely nothing wrong with it. We could identify with it. Because mothers across the race, the racial spectrum would do the same thing to protect the child. And so I did take her seriously to find out what she found, what she had taken issue with.
And I can imagine that that is one of those areas where there's a lot of people who might have an inkling about wanting to write, but that aspect of somebody has to read it keeps them from doing it. Someone has to tell you what they think of it keeps them from doing it. And actually, that was going to be my next question. What is the most difficult aspect of being a writer? One of them could be, as far as, someone has to actually review or someone has to give their opinion on what you've done as a writer. And you mentioned the word thin skin. A lot of people, they have very thin skin and they can't get over that one thing. Do you think that's one of the most difficult aspects of being a writer, or do you think it's something else, William?
I think it's something else, because you embrace that when you embark upon being a writer, because the end result is to be published and to be reviewed by your by the readers. And it strengthens you to improve. It encourages you to improve. Now, take, for example, if a mother or a father were to prepare a meal, they've done the best that they can. It's up to the consumers, those who are eating the meal, Dad, Mom, this is delicious. Or you might be reticent and not say anything and not touch the meal. But then you could turn around and say, well, you can definitely make a peach cobbler, but you suck at making a pound cake. And so when you undertake something like that, you must be prepared to accept the reviews. And it cannot be devastating. Now, Chris, what I had done as a precursor to this, I had my manuscript, and specifically A Murder in Our Midst, and I submitted it to Avon Books, and I asked that for a talent critique, that it was not submitted for a publication consideration. And I specifically asked for one of their most difficult critics. And within about a week, maybe 2 weeks, I forget the time frame, I received a reply. And the lady said, you do have talent. However, do this, do this, do this. And that was quite helpful. That was very insightful for me. And to get what I'm saying is this, there isn't anything worse than to attempt to do something for which you are ill-equipped to do. When I say this, I'm specifically referring to writing. You cannot undertake the genre without a fundamental knowledge of grammar. You must be aware that you write in simple sentences to speed the reader up, compound complex to give information, for example, to define setting, to describe characters. These are the nuances that you must be aware of. And sequence of sentences, to know transitional words and all of this. So the era publishers accepting manuscripts and cleaning it up has been over for a very, very long time. They expect it to be submitted with the proper grammar and be intriguing. But those things don't necessarily mean that your manuscript will be accepted. Because I think publishers have long forgotten that all would-be writers were unknown at one time until they decided to repose faith in them. I read one article where this publisher stated that she read this writer's query letter, and she was just blown completely away, necessitating that she contact him right away because she wanted to sign him up. Well, at any rate, I was wondering what type query letter he had written, how boring was it. And luckily, there was a picture of him. And they have to give the guy credit. He was eye candy. And I think that was the reason she chose him, because the query letter doesn't differ from all others. It's basic.
Mm-hmm.
You're telling the publisher what the book is about, the number of pages, the scenery, and all of this. And so there are no fanciful ways to say this. You can write it yourself. You can hire someone to do it for you. But it's really subjective. It is up to the publisher to say, well, you know what? This sounds interesting. It would be more interesting if the writer had done it as opposed to a professional person doing it. The person might walk in one day and say, you know what? I like this. The person might walk in the same day, no, I don't like this. And now it's getting to the point that the rejection letters are all the same. Good luck, not suited.
Wow. And I just want to say I just appreciate what you mentioned here, because it's definitely an education for any who are contemplating doing it. I felt I was in English class for a half a second there. I had flashbacks. all those points just go into one of the things that I've always said is, one, you have to have the basic tools to show and prove to somebody that you have a capability of doing what you say you can do. Otherwise, you're kind of wasting time. And the dedication that goes into that is one of those mantras where, you know, no one can make you do anything you don't want to do. So when it comes to it, you have to work towards it just like anything else. And no one can believe in you more than you can believe in yourself. So if you have these ideas in your head and you want to put them on paper, there is a right way and a wrong way to do it. You have to be able to have that, you know, education in mind initially, and then be able to have some direction towards that goal, and then go for it, and then we'll see what someone says. So I appreciate all those things. I know all of the audience tonight, 646-652-4479, including the people who are listening from London. I saw some people who I invited to the show click in, and I know they're listening. So we have some overseas listeners already tonight, so I'm excited about that. So that is really, really, really excellent. Let me do this, William, though. I'm eager to start talking about the book a little bit, but we're going to take a quick little break. So can you hold on for us?
Yes, I can, Chris.
Excellent, excellent. So for all who's listening, again, don't go anywhere, because we're going to come right back, and we're going to focus on William's book and, of course, why you should get your own copy, as well as his future plans. We'll be right back. Before we go, it is springtime. Even though it's winter, it's early spring, and a lot of the listeners, they probably are homeowners, and right now, because of this early spring, you're probably being affected by weeds galore, crabgrass, dandelions, all kind of crazy stuff. So one of the things you want to go ahead and start doing now, so that way you don't have to spend money later, is get your lawn treated. True Green is the largest company in the nation now. They can really handle what you have going on. You need to call 404-375-5077 and talk to that representative and see what he can do for you. There is an early spring special out here that's going on for another week or so for any listeners to the show. So definitely make that call, give your information about what's going on with your property and see what they can do. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to come right back with William Turner as we start getting to the meat and potatoes of his book, A Murder in Our Midst. This is Chris, IMTN Worldwide Radio. IMTN Worldwide Radio. We are back live, and we have author William Turner joining us tonight, all the way from California, Pacific time over there. And we are talking about his book, Murder in Our Midst. In the first half of our interview, we were talking about his background and things that led up to him becoming a writer, and he gave us a great education and just the ins and outs of just doing that, but then a lot of the things that experiences specifically that gave him the inference to want to do it. So we're going to bring him back on. Hey, William.
Hi, Chris.
Again, I wanted to say I'm really excited to have you on. I definitely appreciate you taking the time out to join us tonight. And now we get to really get to the nitty-gritty. And, of course, now I'm going to go ahead and prelude this for everybody. No, he's not going to tell you the end of the book. So we're not going to do that. But first and foremost, the title, A Murder in Our Midst. Is this your first book? How long did it take you to write it? What is it about?
Okay, Chris, it is indeed my first book, and I did make some snafus. And it was premised on the friends we meet, specifically interracial friends. It just so happened Raymond Babat and Robert Winchell, both from California, ended up at Harvard, each feeling alienated because they didn't know anyone there, and they became the best of buddies. A friendship was formed. While Raymond, the African-American, was attending Harvard, a man of color in the 50s, his father had died, the last surviving relative. But he was accepted and invited to spend his summers with the Babants, who lived in Pasadena, one of the affluent areas in California, old money. And the family accepted him as one of their own. After graduation, Raymond became, or started working, rather, with his father and his father's businesses, who just so happened to be a multi-billionaire. And Robert decided on becoming a police officer with the LAPD department. After having been passed over for several promotions that he thought he deserved, he became disgruntled and resigned and went to England. Although his letters had been cheerful, Raymond knew something was wrong. And using the family's influence, he found out that Robert had run into the same bigotry in England. And using their international influence, they managed to get him a job with Scotland Yard. At any rate, Robert excelled. He handled a case for the Queen, a most delicate matter, with very little publicity. So impressed was she that she knighted him. And everything was going swimmingly for Robert until he receives a letter from Raymond. Come right away. Someone is trying to kill me and my family. Robert drops everything to go to the aid of his friend, only to arrive late. Raymond was dead. And it was told to Robert that he had terminal cancer, unable to deal with it. He committed suicide. Mm. Robert said, oh, no, no, no. I know my friend. He never would have done anything like that. So he decides to conduct his own investigation of the family that had taken him in, which made it quite awkward for him. And for them. And you just don't come into a country and start an investigation. The suicide was also being investigated by the LAPD. That is where Robert met Detective Dennis. And they found other murders being committed by different culprits, but with a common motive.
Oh.
And it will keep you guessing until the very last page.
Okay, all right. And just some of the bits and pieces in regards to the bio and everything, I'm glad you did that detail because I was just trying to figure out how Scotland Yard and everything. So now that makes sense now. Let me ask you, the character Robert Winchell, is this character pulled from anybody that our listeners would be familiar with, or is he a completely fresh creation from you?
He's a fresh creation. And my friends, some of them are police officers. And after I had written it and after it had been published, I wanted their input because I knew that it would be genuine because one had worked internal affairs. Another was communications, one was homicide. And they each read it, and they said, we love the way you did this, the way it was investigated, the way it was handled. And during that particular time, what makes it so unique is that the friendship was forged during the most turbulent time in American history. With the racial bigotry and the all of the other nuances going on at that particular time, this friendship was forged. And from my readers, they said that it was quite an enviable friendship. And it begged to be asked, and a lot of the readers answered it, how far will you go to effect justice for a friend? And during that particular time is that it was unheard of even a renowned detective, a man of color, investigating an affluent American family. It was absolutely unheard of. And that is one of the aspects that makes it intriguing. But little did I realize it at the time that it would endure and be applicable to present-day situations.
And see, and that's why I titled the show as I did. You know, like I say, I'm quick to put two and two together. And again, that's why I just appreciated, you know, having a chance to have you on tonight. And you kind of answered the next question I was going to ask anyway. Did your past experiences in life play a part in this particular storyline? And you already answered that. So let's go to the next question. of course, and I mentioned this before kind of jokingly, we can't give away the ending of the book, but why should someone get a copy for themselves? Why should someone get this book in particular?
There are a lot of interracial friendships out there, despite what they might see and hear on TV and on the radio, viable friendships, where you can talk about any and everything without becoming angry, hostile, divorcing your friend or whatever. Is that you ask yourself, just how far will I go to effect justice for a friend of mine? I feel that it was written as best I could. It is interesting. And if a friendship can be forged during those times, why not now? And why not as many? And it would address how they did it. Because when Robert would go to the Babant's estate, it was like going from the ghetto to limitless affluence. He would ride up and down and slide down the railing. They would fall back on the bed laughing and all of this. And they didn't see color. They saw the individual. And I tried to convey that.
Mm. Well, it feels that you have, and I can't wait to get a copy for myself. And hint, hint, I want a copy, and be able to, you know, go all the way to the end and be able to now with me knowing this back end information. Definitely, and this goes for you, audience members, also for us to be able to get a chance to read the book and know this information now. And as we go from chapter to chapter, just how all this intertwines with itself. Let me ask you this, William. Over the many years, we've seen, you know, a lot of different books end up on the small screen or even feature film version. Do you think that would or could happen with any of your books? And would you even want that to happen?
I would want it to happen only for the revenue so I can pay off my mortgage. That's all. And it would increase the publicity. But I'm an extremely private person, and I don't invite my privacy being invaded.
Okay.
I'm not sure about A Murder in Our Midst being made into a film, although I am hopeful. But I think I will have greater success with Death Comes for the President, because it has a most unusual plot twist. And I had these two individuals in Texas, and I had no idea what to do with them. And all of a sudden, a story unfolded. And as it did, the different twists, the different nuances manifested themselves. And the publisher wanted to know what the book was about. I was hesitant to disclose the plot, but I did, and they love it. And my agent, my publicist, I told him about it. He was excited to finish. And as we speak, I'm doing the recommended editing on it, and hopefully I will have it. I'll submit it Monday or Tuesday, and it'll be out in April.
Well, wow, congratulations, and you're actually answering some of my questions. I know that you were starting a series of books, and this is going to be The Death Comes for the President. It's going to be that second one, and now we have a possible release date. Excellent. So you see how all this works? I like it. Let me ask you this, William. For those, I got like maybe three more questions for you. For those who have ever thought about becoming a writer, what advice would you give?
First of all, know the genre that you have chosen. Don't attempt to write a romance if you have never had a romance. Because your reader doesn't say that you cannot write it, but it will not be believable. Because most people have had a romance. And if you write something that doesn't make sense, they will be quick to tell you it doesn't make any sense. And you go through using your experience, well, this went wrong. I said the wrong thing to her. I expected the wrong thing from her. I was demanding. I hit her or whatever, or she hit me. And the reader will be able to understand that because they realize from experience there are no perfect romances. They can understand and appreciate the murder of a spouse being pushed to the limit. I think they have very little tolerance for long suffering, being in a situation that's intolerable and just going through the processes. They're miserable, their spouse, their mate is miserable, and all of this. They look for alternatives, affairs, walkaways, or whatever. And if you are more geared toward mysteries, well, in either genre, you must know grammar. That's the first. Mm-hmm. And then second, you research settings. And you can take a course, if you like, on character development, character descriptions, those type things. I didn't have to do this. I was most fortunate. However, to make your work as best you can, you research. And I was reading, well, better still, I was talking to an interviewer, and he told me that Hollywood had done a film on his area, and they had it all wrong. And the people were excited about the film, but they said, oh, no, this is wrong. They didn't get this right in all of this. So the point is to know the setting, know the locale. You don't have to be an expert. And if you are unsure, but you know where you want to set it, get in touch with the local individuals, the municipal departments, and ask for a description of the area. What are the local bars? What are the local streets and all of this? So when you do profile a person's residential area and all of this, they can say, yes, this person took the time to get it right.
That is perfect advice there. It's clear cut. It's understandable. It's doable. Again, folks that are listening, who are the book readers out there and the possible aspiring writers, this is information here that you can't ignore. William, let me ask you this: how can people buy your book? They need to know this.
Chris, it's available on Amazon.com, at Barnes and Noble, and other book outlets.
Excellent. So everybody, Barnes & Noble, Amazon.com, and you can pull it up, of course, by its title, A Murder in Our Midst, and you'll be able to get your own copy. That's very simple, very easy to do. So you should do it, everybody listening. Let me ask you this. How can now I know you mentioned that you are a private person, but if for public appearances or interviews, how can people reach out to be able to do that, William?
You know, like I said, I'm a very private person, and it would be most flattering to do interviews and all of this, but I would respectfully decline.
Okay.
I'm somewhat humble, and it's not to slap myself on the back for being such, but I enjoy living in a community with neighbors where I can go to the mailbox, they wave, I wave, and all they know is that is my neighbor, not a mystery writer. And I like it to be kept that way. Now, one neighbor on one side knows, and they saw the frustration when I was trying to complete the book. And they know I live alone. They would send meals over, whatever, check on me to make sure I'm all right. But that's about the extent of it. It is not that we're at each other's door and all of this. And it was inadvertent that I said that I was a writer, as opposed to just saying, you know what, I retired from state service, and let it go at that.
Gotcha.
But I would not entertain doing any interviews other than what I'm doing with you. You want your privacy. You don't want people knocking on your door asking for autographs, interviews, or anything along those lines. You want to do what you feel you can do and maintain your privacy. You can go out in your sweats, your shorts, and not be bombarded with gawkers or potential people who might think that you are swimming in money and want to rob you and all of this.
Yeah, it's the way of the world nowadays, right?
Yes, Chris.
So, William, I want to say again, I've said it a few times, of course, during the duration of this show, that it was really an honor to have you on the program tonight. I know that the audience was able to appreciate what it means to be able to put thoughts down on paper until they make sense, right, and to be able to follow through until the project is completed. And everything else in between, I just know that people will be able to really, you know, take a second look at themselves if writing is something that they really want to be passionate about, to actually maybe start going forward with it. And definitely, I'm sure that you're going to have some new fans, and they're going to start, you know, paying attention to what you do over the next couple of years with your series. So, again, I really appreciate you being on, William, and taking the time. I hope you'll be able to come on again when the next book comes out. Will that be possible?
It most certainly will, and I'm looking forward to it. And one other thing, Chris, I would like to add. I was very fortunate to have a person by the name of Bates who was reading as I wrote. After I had finished the manuscript of Murder in Our Midst, and I was doing a synopsis to send to the potential publisher, he told me, he says, "Billy, I got something to tell you." I said, "What's that?" He says, "The synopsis is a hell of a lot better than the book." And I thought for a moment, and then I tore the book up and started over. It is good to have a second set of eyes. You don't want them to rewrite the book, but to point out inconsistencies, and you can take it from there.
Oh, you know what? And now, see, that goes back in. I remember again some classes, you know, years ago, and things of that nature, and even stuff that I've done, in the present, in regards to being able to say, "Hey, can you check this for me?" And, you know, take a look at it and get back to me, you know, blah blah blah. Because again, when you're in the zone, you're just going.
Right. You might
and
have thought
you
that you said
that
something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just like even tonight, I missed the word "can" in the, and I know what time it was. It was early, but it's still no excuse. I've never done it before, but I know I was kind of tired that day. But still, just if I had somebody else checking me, I wouldn't have did that. So again, that's another really that's one of the most important points you brought up all night, actually, William. I do appreciate that. So what we're going to do is again. Thank you, William, for being on. I look forward to hearing from you again, okay?
And thank you for interviewing me, Chris. I definitely appreciate the interview.
No problem. You take care and have a nice rest of the weekend, okay?
You too, sir.
An excellent interview, and I do have to give a shout out to Mr. Jerome Cleary for making that interview possible. A little shout out for him. Again, all of those who are listening tonight, definitely try to share this particular show with those who have a love for books, a love for reading, the novels that are out there. You know, there's always something different you can pull from. Here's someone new, here's someone speaking from, you know, past experiences and making it into a whole new story. I think it's going to be really exciting. I'm definitely going to get me a copy. And again, he's creating a whole series of books, so that's going to be even more exciting. So again, I want to thank Will Turner for coming on tonight. I'm going to go ahead and get out of here. For those who are listening, thank you again for taking the time out on a Saturday evening. Hopefully you have a nice, safe rest of the weekend. Of course, Instagram, IMTM Worldwide Radio, IMTM Worldwide. Hit me up on the website, www.imtmworldwide.com. For all business inquiries, you can hit me up from there. Definitely also follow us on blogtalkradio.com/IMTM Worldwide. It's free. Latch on there. You get announcements all the time about the next new show, which should be coming maybe tomorrow. That being said, this is Chris, IMTM Worldwide Radio. Y'all take care. Peace.